This is Art Moves. Art Moves is a series of curated conversations at the intersection of art, innovation, and social justice. Each week, we'll be talking with the innovative thinkers and doers who are forging new ground in the creative arts while redefining what it means to be creative. I'm Tony Williams.
And I'm Eli Kislansky, and we're here with our co-host, Dr. Darrell Cooper.
And our guest today is a woman that I just admire and I just respect because I've known Commissioner of the Department of Cultural Affairs, Lori Cumbo, for maybe 30 years, you know, and just seen such an evolution into the woman that you are now and the impact that you have made in Brooklyn. I just had to say that. Shout you out. Ooh. A Spelman woman. So as we get to talking to you, Lori, I wanted to talk about your transition from Mikado, from art, to being a city councilwoman. And then, of course, now you are the commissioner of the Department of Cultural Affairs. What was that like?
Wow. This journey has been taking place long before I realized it was taking place.
Most good journeys, right? Right.
And it started even before I was born. And I often, you know, I could go so far back in terms of saying and telling the story of how I got here. But for so much of it, it was my mom coming from Detroit, Michigan to New York City to study at Juilliard.
Oh,
and that really for her dream to come to New York City to essentially live out her dream. And that vision of hers and that desire transitioned into her now being what's known as a super at the Met, which means that you are essentially an actor in each of the Met Opera's productions. I essentially ran for city council because I believed that I had a bigger mission for the arts. And while I was trying to accomplish my goal by creating the Mikado Museum, I just felt that there were so many people in the community that continuously asked me, can you lead a crowd to go to Albany to advocate for the arts? Can you lead a march or a rally at City Hall to fight for the arts? So I was leaving my museum to fight for the whole to such an extent that I felt like I might as well go into city government and to make that my full-time job. To advocate for the arts, to advocate for essential services. And what I really learned is that, and this is the takeaway on so many levels for people, those issues that you really care about, that you see not represented inside of government, you've got to be inside. You have to run for office. You have to bring your passion to those positions. If you feel that the disability community is not represented the way it should be, you've got to pick up that mantle and you've got to run for office. If you feel that people of color, the LGBTQ, and we saw an incredible outpouring of candidates that were women for the very first time. As you're seeing in New York City Council, there are more women in the New York City Council than ever before. We're seeing that also in Congress. And so these are the dynamics and the changes and the shifts that I feel so much a part of. When I ran for office as an African-American woman, there were only 12 women in city government at that time. We ran a campaign called 21 and 21, mm-hmm. looking to get 21 right. women, and that was going to be the victory. But now there are over 30 women. The Absolutely. Campaign was so right. successful. Mm-hmm. So the change that you want to see, you have to be it.
You got to be the change.
You've got to be the change.
Yes, it's more than just a slogan.
That's
yeah.
right.
Yeah.
And so I transitioned from running an art museum into city government, but my way of approaching government was still from an artistic lens, still from a creative lens, from thinking outside of the box, from bringing untraditional players to the table to work out ideas and to come up with solutions. It was a transition, but one in which I knew that the arts were a key essential part of any solution we were talking about, whether it was public safety, whether it was education, whether it was workforce development, embedding the arts into all those key solutions, housing, creativity in our creative spaces.
I think it should be in business spaces as well,
in
energy companies.
Spaces,
I think exactly.
We can't have STEM, we can only have STEAM.
Right, right. And you have a PEAR program. Because
yes.
Talk a little bit about that, only because this is right what you're talking about.
That's right. Mm-hmm. So our PEAR program is our Public Artists in Residence program. Mm-hmm. And this I can't take credit for as much as I would love to, but I take credit for continuing its success. We have an all-call process where we invite artists to submit proposals and applications in terms of how can we utilize artists within city government agencies.
Isn't that interesting?
That's very
right?
Serious, right?
So artists mm-hmm. would have an opportunity to come into the police department, homeless services, child welfare services, the Department of Education, immigrant affairs, and they would work with the entire agency to identify what are the key issues that your agency is facing. Where are you stuck? Where can't you find a solution to an issue that plagues your community, that continues to have you scratching your head? And artists come in, they look at the issue, they talk with the clients that utilize this agency. They talk with the executive leadership, those that are on the ground making the policies and implementing them. And they come up with creative ways and creative solutions to help those agencies work right. through those really difficult and challenging problems. And it's an incredible opportunity for the arts to be at the center of changing the way we think, providing new ideas and new solutions that may not come from the agency who's been dealing with it day in and day out.
So Lori, a little known fact, I am a recovering program officer from the New York City Department of Cultural Affairs in a past life.
Wow.
Yes. Although, when I was there, it was before this huge global pandemic. Right. Came through. I'm just curious, you know, what are some of the things that you're hearing from, you know, the citizens of New York City as you're going around talking to them? What are some of the topics that are trending as paramount and really important in the different communities?
I would say from an institutional and organizational perspective, while many people want to tout that New York City is back, many cultural organizations are still recognizing and grappling with the fact that, no, we're not quite back
I would think
yet.
That exactly, right?
Right? Mm-hmm. That audience attendance numbers are not where they need to be. Many of the performance halls are also noting that their numbers have not returned or rebounded in the way that people anticipated. And so there is a friction in terms of the celebration of New York City being quote unquote back, and many cultural institutions facing the fact that we're not, but that when we tout that we're back, we forget that organizations still need critical support. They still need services. They still need to be supplemented in a way that they are allowed to manage through this pandemic and crises that we're still in. And still receive the necessary support and recognizing that they need support, they need subsidy, they need for foundations, corporations, individuals to really wrap their arms around these cultural institutions and shore them up, not just for the immediate, but really the long term. Because I put, you can't see it on the podcast, but I put in quotes, we're back, because I do not like to verbalize that we're back. We are moving forward, and New York is moving forward. And I don't want to say back, because we have to recognize that this pandemic was an opportunity for us to learn some key lessons, for us to understand how we have to change and create some paradigm shifts in terms of who our audiences are, how we serve them, who's at the table. What are we exhibiting? Who is performing? These are all key questions. Who do we give voice to? How do we now recognize that who is essential has changed, right? The pandemic showed us that who is essential depends so much on what the set of circumstances are. Mm-hmm. And at any given time, you could be essential or you could not be, in terms of what the dynamics and the parameters are, which teaches us at the end of the day that we're all essential, because it just depends on the dynamics of what the set of circumstances are that determines that, which are always evolving and always changing. So we've learned a lot from this pandemic, and we should move forward in a way that recognizes that we will never be what we were. We have to resist the desire to go back to shore with what's so comfortable, even though it was uncomfortable. And we have to continue to move forward, even though we don't know what that's going to look like. We don't know how that's going to appear. And I feel that so much of what we're experiencing and seeing is that a major shift is changing. And some people can't understand how they fit within that shift, and they resist. And that resist looks like a lot of the tension that we're seeing, because essentially this country was founded on a very tragic, unfortunate set of circumstances that are trying desperately to right themselves.
Right. Wow. Very, yes.
And
absolutely.
That's the shift
that's
we're
it.
Seeing.
Exactly.
You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM.
And we're talking to Laurie Combo, who is the current commissioner of Cultural Affairs.
I knew you'd get that. There That's right.
It's on the page.
Right. Yeah.
So there is a puritanical view of the arts that is like, what do we need it for? Mm-hmm. Actually, sounds kind of like my uncle's. Mm-hmm. So, but then I think, imagine that must have an impact on where and how you invest in the arts, right? Because it's a significant budget. It's like, is it right? $200 million in New York, largest in the country.
Expense budget, yes.
Yeah, expense budget.
But our capital budget.
This is the thing.
$4 million.
It carries over a year.
Right. Yeah. Yes. You know your stuff.
Yes. This sounds
it's about $500 million.
Yes. Yeah, that sounds
And this is the largest cultural budget in the country.
Right.
And so to be in this position at this particular time is an incredible opportunity. And what I try to do is similar to what I was working on doing in city council, was embedding the arts in the work of the different agencies so that we see art as a tool, whether it's public safety, whether it's Department of Education. We need to make sure that art is a part of every solution that we come up with. So I was chair of the Women's Issues Committee and on the Arts and Culture Committee for the City Council. But in that, I still passed legislation to create the mayor's office to end gun violence, right? So it's recognizing that these, and I created an initiative called Art as a Catalyst for Change. And that initiative was designed to place after school art programming in communities most impacted by gun violence. And that was in the City Council. And now as commissioner, I now oversee the initiative that I created in the City Council. And I really strongly and firmly believe that, particularly for our young people, when their talents and passions are realized and then nurtured and cultivated, you are going to experience and see a more vibrant, safer New York City. And that is my goal, along with the Adams administration, to make sure that every young person has an opportunity to have a summer youth employment. And of course, we're going to have summer youth employment. And someone would say, well, what does that have to do with the arts? I am inducting and in advertising and promoting for every cultural institution in the city of New York. You should be a provider for the summer youth employment program. This should be the grounds in which you train the next generation of art leaders. And we should start at summer youth employment. So in every situation, I'm like, we have to have an arts partner to that. We have to make sure that the arts are embedded in that.
Now, I think that's an excellent idea, because it's like bringing all of these cross-functional things together to make a really synergistic opportunity for some of these young people.
That's right.
Well, thinking about Create NYC.
Yes.
That was a plan, I think it was 2017, mm-hmm. when that was created under the de Blasio administration. Where is that? Or is that a plan that you're still...
Create NYC is so exciting because mm-hmm. I was a council member when the legislation came forward. And it was Councilmember Brad Lander, Councilmember Jimmy Van Raymer, Councilmember Steve Levin, and myself. We were huge components of this. Most major cities throughout the country have a cultural plan. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to make sure that, of course, we're New York City.
Please, we're the Mecca.
Right? We're the cultural capital of the world. Right. We needed a cultural plan. And I would say that, of course, following the implementation of the cultural plan, we did get hit by COVID. But at the same time, some really incredible dynamics have come out of the cultural plan. Part of that is making sure that we have paid closer attention to our disability community. So now we have a disability officer within our agency to make sure that we are rooting disability in all the work that we're doing and making sure that we become a more accessible New York City. Language access was a huge component of the cultural plan. And we wanted to make sure that institutions understand that we have to make our collections, our performances, presentations, and events more language accessible and providing the resources and the funding to actually make that happen. We also, out of that came our CDF reforms. So the cultural development forms. So
Fund. Yeah, yeah, I want to hear it. Yes, if you could speak about what that is, because perhaps some of our listeners won't know what that is. Right.
So the cultural development fund, and this is where
that's where I worked,
cut your teeth, right? The CDF fund is what the Department of Cultural Affairs is most known for. Mm-hmm. Most people see us as a grant-making agency. We are very proud of it. While our portfolio is much larger than the CDF process, it's a major part of how people identify with us. Mm-hmm. And the application deadline was actually due yesterday at 5 p.m., where we fund approximately 1,200 organizations through the CDF process. It's a panel review process. And some of the reforms that came out was that we raised the floor from $5,000 to $10,000. So everyone applying get $10,000 because we know that application.
The work it takes.
And the work that it takes.
$10,000 for that. Yes,
right?
Please.
So we wanted to make sure that with the CDF process that it was more accessible. We wanted to make sure that we ended the process of it being a two-part application where you do one part and then there was another part due. So now it's one application. We implemented Salesforce as a new software system in order to make the process more streamlined. So there were many things that we wanted to do, but we also wanted to level the playing field. And one of the things that we did through this process is we funded 125 new organizations that had never been funded before.
Wow.
And the majority of those are BIPOC-led, and we wanted to make sure that we opened up the process to smaller not-for-profit organizations, that we did webinars, we did training so that organizations would know how to apply.
Right.
And
right,
it's so critical for you to become a part of this process because that then opens the doors for you to be in alignment with receiving capital dollars.
I see.
And capital dollars are what our administration allocates for building expansion projects, capital projects, new infrastructure, computer systems, equipment. That's really where organizations have the ability to grow and expand.
What do you see as the real benefit of continued long-term investment from the government, and not just city, but from the government, where organizations don't have to apply, but it's a given that they will be invested in year after year?
I mean, that is certainly the dream. And when we look at many of our European brothers and sisters and that level of support, it's phenomenal. But what I would say is that when I look at Mocada and my ability to begin and fund Mocada, my ability to start that museum would not be as easily accessible in Europe. It's more so the organizations that are there, and they are there. The opportunity for you to come along as a 22-year-old graduate student with a thesis and say, I want 100% government funding for my African diaspora museum, does not have the same pathway in order to receive that level of support. I think the incredible part of in New York City is that if you have a dream and you're able to fill out a grant and you're able to get into that process, then you're able to figure out a pathway that allows you to be able to enter the cultural world. The barriers in many other countries don't allow for you to have a National Black Theater, a Studio Museum, a Schomburg, a Weeksville, a 651 Arts. Like, there's nothing like that anywhere in the world where you're seeing Pregones Theater, Afro-Latin Jazz Alliance. I was able to just allocate $7.2 million to Arturo Farrell's Afro-Jazz Alliance, which is you know, to be in a position like that, that you could make this a reality. The new hip hop museum is going to open next year.
Yes.
This is going to be game changing, and to be and to have a front row seat at making this happen. If you look at New York Historical Society, they are going to build the first comprehensive LGBTQ museum in New York City. This doesn't happen anywhere else in the world. No one can tout the level of diversity, small, medium-sized, large institutions, the brand new ones that continue to come online. We're going to cut the ribbon on the Louis Armstrong House. We just celebrated the ribbon cutting for the Gilder Center at American Museum of Natural History. Right before that, we cut the ribbon on the first Bronx Children's Museum's first brick and mortar home.
Yes.
So like this level of excitement and energy what keeps people coming to New York City, because there are going to be dozens of new museums coming online, cultural institutions, theaters, performances, festivals. Every time you come, there's something different. There's something new to see. And no other country in the world can tout that level of excitement. So there are pros and cons to both approaches. If I had my dream of dream, all the ones that come online would have all the government support in the world, and it would just be fantastic. But I do think that there is something special to government, corporate, foundation, individuals, fundraisers, crowdsourcing, social media, calling up friends and family. Like, we need you
to gather
arms around this institution and love on this institution financially, socially, spiritually, and let's birth it and let's bring it together as a whole community. There's something beautiful about it. Challenging, but beautiful.
You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM, and we are just really drinking in the enthusiasm of our Commissioner Lori Cumbaul.
Actually, I have a question, but actually, I was sitting here and I was thinking about the scale that people don't realize about the arts, because I think it's a multi-billion-dollar industry in New York and New York State, right? Like $14 billion industry or something.
The numbers continue to rise, to grow.
Right? And who sources
it's
it?
It's massive.
It's massive.
Right. Yes.
No, it's interesting. I had many years ago. I was sitting in a limousine with Ford Bell, who at that time was the president of the American Lions and Museum, and he told me that the national visitorship in cultural centers across the board, across the country, is 850 million people.
Around the ballpark that I've heard, yes. Right. It's a little bit down since COVID, but yes. Right.
Around that. And you said there was like 160 million or so that go to sports games all together.
Right. Nowhere near the same.
Nowhere near that.
That's right. You know, we're not in competition. We recognize that the sports and athletic world is deserving, wonderful, and great, and does extraordinary things for cities. But art also achieves many of those goals in terms of attracting people, providing educational
resources.
Everyone
can participate.
Everybody can participate.
We're watching the game, but we can get into art.
That's right. You know what I mean?
It's very different.
That's interesting, right? We can be part of it. I agree with that. The other thing I was saying, it also addresses this thing about the puritanical view about what do you need it for? Mm-hmm. Like, why is art so important? What do you need it? Because there is that attitude out there. But anyways, I had a question about affordability, because as you know, a lot of these institutions are not that affordable, and in some ways not that accessible, you know, if you look at type of shows that shows in museums and such. So how do you plan to address some of those issues? And I'm sure on some of your programs and also strategies and stuff, you're thinking about this.
We require all of the institutions to make sure that they have free days, that they have hours that are accessible to the community, that we make sure that there are certain time periods where people can come to the institutions for free. There are a lot of organizations, the Cultural Pass program. There's also the opportunities for families through Cool Culture. Many organizations have passes that they distribute to the community to make sure that there is a level of accessibility. And so it's certainly something that challenges me on many levels in terms of how do we continue to work to make sure that our institutions are accessible and free when possible, because you never want for a family to make a choice not to go because they can't afford it. And so I would say in my tenure as commissioner, I've only been here now for a year, but it's certainly something that I continue to address, work on, and try to see how can we create a more accessible and affordable experience for everyday New Yorkers, working families, and making sure that they are affordable to our communities.
What about the fact that a lot of our artists can no longer afford to live here? Is there anything that can be done about that? Mm-hmm. You know, quite honestly, artists make neighborhoods, you know, they revitalize and then they can't afford, you know, and then they can't afford to rent and they're pushed out. Any thinking on that at all?
Let me tell you, it's my dream of all dreams to crack the nut on creating affordable housing for artists. And, you know, just to be frank, in terms of my research, working with HPD Commissioner Adolfo Carrion, he too wants to see this become a reality in our housing. What we found, and I'm working on trying to address this. What we found was that there are so many laws, particularly on the federal and state level, that state that you cannot prioritize housing by profession.
Right.
So that's where the loophole goes, once you do it for the artistic community, then firefighters and then nurses and then
teachers, for goodness sake, right?
Yes. Well, we should be prioritized because we want to work and live where our school is. And on the public safety, we should be prioritized because we want to keep the communities that we keep safe. We want to live in them. So that's one challenge, right? So we have to work within the parameters of determining how can the arts community and artists not be seen, not the right word necessarily, but as a profession, that they're in some other category because of what they bring to a city and for what they do within the city. The other challenge that we have is that how somebody would be identified as an artist,
That could be a real big basket, right? That's a big tent,
right?
Very big tent. Yeah.
Top of that, it also cuts into racial lines, because when they do the assessment of who is considered an artist right day, right now, would not be the majority of the BIPOC community and African American communities more specifically.
Why is that so?
Right? So you could pass artist housing, but that would not mean that communities of color would see more artists of color popping up in their community.
I see.
Right? Yeah. So this hits on two different levels that we're trying to solve for.
But you know something, you're the right person to solve for it.
That's right.
Right. Yep. You've got the right combination of skills. You've been in city government.
That's right.
And you are an artist.
That's right.
So unfortunately, though, this is all the time we have, but we're going to bring you.
I know. What?
I'm like, I just got started. But, you know, they're giving me the signal. So
I saved all my good stuff and now
it's so good.
Part two?
Yeah, right. Part two.
We'll have you back.
We're going to have to.
I would love to come back.
Oh, excellent. Thank you so much.
This was wonderful.
And you are.
Thank you.
Art Moves is co-produced with Brick Arts Media and recorded at Brick Studio. This has been Art Moves with your host, Tony Williams.
And Eli Kaslansky and our distinguished co-host, Dr. Darrell Cooper.
Find some art that moves you and share it with someone.